This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. And by Unmanned Systems and Solutions, USAS, a combat veteran-owned company that repairs all types of drones. If you're a consumer who owns a drone, a small business using drones, or a drone manufacturer looking for sophisticated repair, distribution, and warehousing, look into USAS. For more information, visit unmannedsas.com/UAV Digest. You're listening to episode 187 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut. David Vanderhoof is off this week. As many of you know, his father passed away recently, and David has some other obligations to tend to, of course. And certainly our thoughts are with David and his family. Now, I am, however, joined by a guest this episode. That's Dr. Benjamin Gould. He's a chemical engineer in the chemistry division at the Naval Research Laboratory, the NRL, and an expert in the field of fuel cell power systems. He specializes in the development of next-generation power sources for the U.S. Navy. Now, you'll recall that earlier this year, we talked about the work the NRL is doing with fuel cells, specifically the Ion Tiger unmanned air vehicle and the new custom hydrogen fuel cell designed and built at NRL. So, Ben, welcome to the UAV Digest.
Thank you very much, Max.
Let's jump right in and talk about the reasons why we consider fuel cells for unmanned aircraft. Why do we do that?
Well, I think the first reason that comes to mind is to increase endurance. You know, fuel cells, when we look at the unmanned aircraft, we're really looking at the swap, the size, weight, and power as compared to other power sources. Usually we're looking at sort of the smaller class of UAVs, you know, under 55 pounds, so that fits perfectly for drones. And in that sort of range, your power sources are really batteries or internal combustion engines. Fuel cells have increased endurance over those two power sources. They also have the benefit of they produce water as their only exhaust, so they're clean as well.
It's sort of a nice combination. We do see fuel cells being employed here and there commercially, but I think there's a lot of potential for that. Maybe you can give us just a kind of an overview of how fuel cells work. What's the chemistry that's going on there?
Sure thing, Max. I think when I think of a fuel cell, the first way I like to think about it is it's an electrochemical engine. So really, I'm, in our case, burning a fuel, hydrogen, into water. Just like you would burn rocket fuel in a space shuttle, it's the same reaction, but in a space shuttle, I'm making heat and gas and exhausting it through a nozzle. If I was burning it in an internal combustion engine, I'd be moving a piston. In the fuel cell, we're basically burning it electrochemically. So we bring in hydrogen into what we call the anode. There it does some chemical magic that I don't want to completely bore your listeners with, but it's basically what we call the hydrogen oxidation reaction. That takes place on a catalyst. There, we're basically able to split the hydrogen into its proton and electron and move the electron through an external circuit where it can combine with air that it scavenges from the environment, the oxygen from the air and the external environment, recombine to form water and drive power in that reaction.
Now, are there any size constraints on these? The fuel cells that I'm familiar with are either, well, I guess, used with spacecraft, or I've seen some large industrial fuel cells that are, maybe about the size of a small automobile. Can these be scaled down to something very small and tiny that would work for a UAV?
Oh, yeah, they're very modular. There are limits. You know, they're sort of in that size range of where I said, you know, sort of above maybe 2 pounds up to like 55 pounds. If you have a very large vehicle, you know, gas turbines start looking very attractive, like a jumbo jet, right, in terms of efficiency. Fuel cells are very efficient at converting stored chemical energy to electrical power, but it doesn't compete very well when things are very, very large or super, super small. Like if you're looking at things that are, you know, the size of insects, a really, really micro UAV, you would have to go to a battery for that. But in between, very, very scalable.
Now, we usually hear about hydrogen being the fuel, and that's what you mentioned. But aren't there some other possible fuels that can be used in fuel cells? And why is hydrogen so popular for these?
Well, that's a great question. So there are multiple fuels that can be used. Hydrogen is the most prevalent one. There's a type of fuel cell called a solid oxide fuel cell. It can run on methane and hydrocarbons that are usually pre-reformed. So it can run on normal sort of fossil fuels, but it runs at very, very high temperature to accomplish this. It's usually targeted more towards a lot of stationary power applications, but people are trying to move them into UAVs with some success. Another type of fuel cell would be a phosphoric acid fuel cell. That's a fairly old technology. Actually, during the 2003 blackout in the East Coast, the lights in Central Park stayed on. They were being run by a phosphoric acid fuel cell powered by the natural gas grid.
Interesting.
People have looked at direct methanol as well as propane fuels. Fuel cells are run on propane, but really hydrogen is the king right now, or you see it the most, because the automotive companies did a lot of trade studies and looked at all these different sort of combinations, and they found that basically, if you want the most lightweight, simple system, hydrogen is the best fuel to react because it's very reactive. It's a very light molecule that stores a lot of energy without a lot of weight, and it's relatively easy to handle in terms of materials and temperatures. And basically, as I talked about earlier in the fuel cell, we have the hydrogen oxidation reaction to convert it to a proton. The big development in fuel cells in the 90s basically happened. They were able to make new polymers that can move protons. And so hydrogen is really close to becoming a proton. So that's why hydrogen is basically favored.
Interesting. So in the application of a fuel cell for a drone, so we're talking about the hydrogen being, I guess, in a compressed state, I would imagine, a little, container for the compressed hydrogen?
Correct. We've actually flown UAVs of both compressed gaseous hydrogen and liquid hydrogen are your two options. But compressed gas is the easiest to do just because of what they call the airport problem. Actually, automotive industry looked at liquid hydrogen as well, but you know, if you park your car at the airport, when something is liquid hydrogen, it's always boiling off. You're always losing some of it. You can't store it indefinitely. Where with compressed hydrogen, you can pump it up into a tank and you can hold it there and come back and it still has the fuel in the vehicle.
Describe for us, Ben, the fuel cell that you all have developed there, and tell us about kind of the size and the power output, some of the characteristics of the fuel cell that you've been using in the Ion Tiger.
Okay, yeah, so we're working on sort of a next generation of fuel cell based on what we call metal bipolar plates. A good way to think of the bipolar plate is it's the backbone of the fuel cell. So there's really two components when you think of a fuel cell. There's the heart, which is what we call the electrode or the electrocatalyst, and then the backbone, the bipolar plate. This is the method that the big automotive manufacturers are looking at for producing fuel cell engines in cars, and we want to leverage their investment. So really what's unique about our fuel cell is it uses metal plates, which should hopefully be cheaper than other technologies and easier to scale in mass production. Our fuel cell is scalable from about 1 kilowatt to 5 kilowatts, and we're looking to target about 1 kilowatt per kilogram in terms of specific power, which makes it pretty sporty.
How does that compare to more conventional lithium polymer batteries that might be used in a drone?
It compares very, very well. So when you want to look at the trades in terms of power sources, there's something called the Ragone plot, which basically plots your specific power, watts per kilogram, versus your specific energy, watt hours per kilogram. So how much energy you're storing versus how much power you can put out. Batteries can put out more power than a fuel cell, but they don't store energy very well, so their endurance is limited. So we have about a 6x to sometimes 8x improvement over lithium-ion batteries. So if you look at our fuel cell system, we can store about 1,200 watt-hours per kilogram, whereas I think a typical lithium-ion battery is around 300 watt-hours per kilogram. Hmm.
What is the size and weight of the fuel cell like that?
We're around 1 kilowatt per kilogram, so if we're looking at a 5-kilowatt system, we're about 5 kilograms. Hmm. The volume, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head. It's not huge, you know, think bread box.
Okay, so it's larger than would be the case for a battery of equivalent power, but which, as you say, what you get is a much greater duration.
Yeah.
Now, you're also involved in additive manufacturing, I understand. 3D printing is what, you know, many people know it by. Have you been applying that to the construction of these fuel cells?
We have, actually. We were the first group to ever build a fuel cell with a 3D printed bipolar plate, as far as I know. So we really wanted to do that just to test out the technology in 3D printing. Not a lot of people know you can actually 3D print in metal, which is really, really cool. We've actually been partnering with some of our partners at Walter Reed Medical Center, who work on Wounded Warrior prosthetics, that actually make these metal parts for us, and some other companies as well. And so, yes, you can make structures you could never make by any other means using 3D printing. What's really cool is you can make hollow bipolar plates, so hollow backbones, which is really handy for a fuel cell because you need to cool it, just like an engine. Like your normal engine has a radiator in your car, you need a radiator and a fuel cell. And if you can make hollow structures, you can pump the coolant through those hollow structures.
Interesting. So where is the Ion Tiger now in its development and the research activities that you're carrying on? Do you see working with it for an extended period of time, or are you sort of at the end of the research cycle? Where are you on that timeline?
The Ion Tiger has been a really great test bench. We're still using it now for a lot of experiments. It's just like a great known airframe. Hmm. So we're going to still be continuing using it in the future for other programs just because we have such a great history of data on it. It's great to try to fly different systems on it. So that's what's happening with the Ion Tiger. And we're grateful to ONR, the Office of Naval Research, for helping us fund and develop that vehicle. It's been a real workhorse for us.
Tell me about the funding from the NRL. What is their sort of interest in developing this kind of technology?
We're funded mostly from the Office of Naval Research to the NRL, and I think the real interest is in increasing capability for the Navy, you know, being able to go faster, farther, longer, really just, you know, what is, you know, the next generation of power sources for UAV aviation so we can really, you know, perform longer missions, stay on station longer.
And do you have any predictions for when this might enter the commercial realm? We may be able to bring up Amazon.com, let's say, and order a fuel cell for our drone?
It's tough to make predictions. I think we're getting really close. I mean, a lot of people don't know, but fuel cells are actually a fairly old technology. They actually have been around since 1839, which is 20 years before the internal combustion engine for gasoline. So we're making great strides. Right now, there's still some challenges in terms of expense, but that's coming down rapidly as the automotive manufacturers are really looking to wring out costs. I don't know how much you know about the automotive industry as a whole, but it's all about, you know, pennies on the dollar and squeezing out every little ounce of profit. And so really, that's going to help, I think, you know, drive this next generation of hopefully UAVs powered by fuel cells. But hopefully soon.
I've always thought it's interesting how these industries that on first blush you may think are not connected, how they really do overlap. And you look at autonomous automobiles and you look at autonomous drones. You look at powering devices like you're speaking of here, and there's also overlap. There really is a lot of interesting technology being developed in these different industries that really does impact, other areas as well. I don't know how well it's all coordinated, how much of that synergy is being taken advantage of. I don't know, any kind of thoughts on that?
No, absolutely. That's so true, how all the sort of technology sort of cross-pollinates each other. You don't even realize it when you're sort of in the community working on it. And that's part of what we do here at the NRL is we're trying to take that long view and survey all the technology for the Navy and bring it in and coordinate it into, what the next generation of the Navy could look like over the horizon. So that's really what we're trying to do here is, look at autonomy, pull that together with power sources. We actually have an entire building on the lab called the Laboratory for Autonomous Systems, or LASER. There was a building just dedicated to developing new autonomous systems.
Yes, fascinating. So what about the availability of hydrogen? If you have a fuel cell, you've maybe purchased one or built one yourself, is hydrogen difficult to obtain?
Not on an industrial scale, but I think that leads to a really good question. We talked about, what are some of the future barriers? The fuel cells are getting really good. It's actually sort of the hydrogen infrastructure that needs to come now and backfill, right? You could build a drone with a hydrogen-powered fuel cell pretty easily, but if someone wanted to use it, how are they going to, recharge their drone as compared to a battery? So I think, you're going to see that coming in the future, and we actually have research projects looking at just that. They call this the chicken and the egg argument in the industries, right? The car manufacturers want to build fuel cell cars, but they need oil companies to build fuel cell gas stations, but oil companies don't want to build fuel cell gas stations unless they're fuel cell cars, right? So it's kind of one of these interesting sort of chicken and the egg, but it's great from the government perspective. We can do both because it's in our sort of purview.
Interesting dilemma. I think that I don't know how far into the future, but at some point in the future, folks will look back on us asking questions like, where do I get hydrogen from? And probably laugh at how primitive we were, how backward we were at that point.
You were saying we can get hydrogen from a lot of feedstocks. One of the great things about hydrogen is we can get it from renewable feedstocks. We can electrolyze water and make it from water using solar power, or we can get it from hydrocarbons, right? So it lets fossil fuels and renewable energy compete sort of on a common foothold. That's also what's sort of neat about electric vehicles as well. Before then, if you even had your, back in the 80s, if you had your PV array on your house, it could heat your house, but you had really no option to have it to drive your car. But hydrogen gives you a way to store chemical energy that it could come from fossil or renewable, and they can compete on a common foothold. So if you actually look at hydrogen industrially, the majority of hydrogen is produced from natural gas at present.
All right. Well, what are the next flights that you anticipate this summer? I guess probably with the winter coming to a close here, maybe you'll have more of an opportunity to do some flights. Anything coming up this summer?
Yeah, we're looking at doing a fuel cell powered UAV with solar panels as well. So there's some interest in looking at combining the technologies this summer. So I think that's coming off. We're also looking at maybe trying to do a flight with a new kind of fuel cell I'm very excited about and working on with an open cathode architecture. So when we say fuel cell, that's really a catch-all for what we actually call a fuel cell system. And inside that fuel cell system is a fuel cell stack. So many, many fuel cells stacked up like a sandwich. So really when we say fuel cell, that'd be like saying we have a piston in an engine. Really need multiple pistons and other things to make a power source. But in an open cathode fuel cell, instead of, if you imagine a sandwich, a club sandwich with meat bread, meat, bread. We're going to unfold that out into an array and try to put the fuel cell on the wing of an aircraft.
Interesting stuff. That's one of the exciting things about unmanned aircraft, drones, UAS, is just all these technologies are being looked at. Many of them maybe would have been otherwise, but it seems like there's sort of an acceleration of interest in a lot of new technologies, new hardware, new software, new control systems. It's kind of resulting from this sort of exploding industry of unmanned aircraft. Kind of exciting times. The people that you work with in the lab, what sorts of people are they? What kinds of backgrounds? Who are they?
It's a very exciting time to be in both the UAV sector and in fuel cells. I'm just incredibly privileged to work on it. And really, in terms of people, it's all about interdisciplinary teams. We have, you know, fundamental electrochemists and theorists who work on the very, very, you know, nanoscale, nano architecture. We have all the way up to aeronautical engineers designing airplanes. We have mechanical engineers in between doing subsystems. I'm a chemical engineer that kind of bridges between the chemistry world and the mechanical world. But it's just, you know, you need a big team to do these kind of things. So it's, you know, great for students to stay in school and learn mathematics and stick with your science so you can go do these really cool things in the future.
Yes. All right. And finally, are there any resources, website or places where people who are interested in learning more about what the NRL is doing, let's say, or fuel cells in general, places that you might direct our listeners to?
Yeah, sure. I'd go to the NRL webpage. There's a lot of press releases and documents there you can look at and links to our papers. You can also Google my name and any sort of scholarly research document, or my boss, Karen Swider-Lyons. You should get 50 sub-papers on fuel cells and fuel cell UAVs. And then lastly, your local library. I'd look at Fuel Cell Systems Explained. It's a great textbook I used when I was in university, which is a really good overview of fuel cell technologies in general. If you're looking at the future of additive manufacturing or 3D printing, I think the real future is in machines that can do both additive and subtractive manufacturing. You're going to want something that does, you know, your 3D printing and a CNC milling operation on top of one another. Who'd want a car that just turns left?
That's interesting. I haven't seen, I don't think I've seen any kind of machinery that does both additive and subtractive. Usually it's one or the other. So that's an interesting idea to have them blended in that way.
Yeah, I think that's what you're going to see. And actually, I think there's a YouTube video that just came out recently of that. I think it's maybe a company, DMG Mori, or I can't remember who it is, but basically, like, it's a really cool video where they, you know, they're using powder deposition fusion, where they're basically, they're blowing a metal powder, and they imagine they grow like a pipe manifold, and it's halfway open, and then the machine, you know, puts down the 3D printing head and picks up a CNC mill tool and goes back and drills holes and polishes the inside surface basically on a five-axis trunnion. Then it goes back and grabs the 3D printing head and then encloses that like in a dome. It's like really, really cool.
Huh, fascinating. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Benjamin Gould, for giving us sort of an overview. We've been talking about fuel cells over the past few weeks and months, and it's great to have somebody who really understands these and can give us some perspective on fuel cells and how they apply to unmanned aircraft. So again, Ben, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, we do have some news stories that we actually had lined up for last week. Again, you probably know that we didn't publish last week because of, when the host has laryngitis, it's difficult to do a podcast. But we did have some stories lined up. We'll put those in the show notes. I can just describe them briefly. We talk about Tel Aviv-based Aerobotics. And they wanted to build a drone that didn't require a human operator. one that could take off, fly a pre-programmed flight, let's say, for up to 30 minutes and land without human assistance. And they now say they've developed a platform. They say it's fully automated, industrial grade, on-demand, and multi-purpose. And we'll have an article about that. Also, a video that shows this automated landing box, which includes a robotic arm for automatic payload and battery exchange. Very interesting. Also, the U.S. Air Force is looking at a quadcopter that's actually been tested for maintenance inspection of a C-17 cargo plane. This was at Edwards Air Force Base. They've flown a number of sorties with a 3D Robotics Solo quadcopter. They're going to take a look and see if the resolution from the video is good enough to see the small details and so forth. But this is the first time that a quadcopter has been used for this kind of inspection of an aircraft on the flight line. Also, we see that Canadian UAVs Incorporated and Lockheed Martin CDL Systems, they're teaming up for beyond visual line of sight inspections, things like pipelines and wellheads, power lines, and so forth. They've been using a Lockheed Martin Indigo 2 quadcopter, and they've been testing this in Alberta. I have an article on that. Also, we'll have something in the show notes about Bodie McBoatface. That's right, Bodie McBoatface. If you haven't heard, that's a British UAV. But in this case, it's an underwater autonomous vehicle. And they are planning to use this to collect data about the effects of global warming on the world's oceans. We'll have something in there about that. Also, Windhorse Aerospace. They're developing a prototype of a delta wing drone they call the Pouncer. Now, this is a single-use drone. The idea is it's designed to carry food and supplies on humanitarian missions. The company Windhorse says that, quote, its preformed shell can be used to provide shelter, the frame can be burnt safely to cook food, and the payload, which is food and water, provides life-saving nutrition. But interestingly, they also say that one day the airframe itself may be made out of edible components. So you check that out in the show notes. And then, of course, another week goes by or two, and we have some more Amazon patents. They've patented a couple of concepts. One is a drone that has telescoping legs. Think of a tripod used for a camera. This is seen as a way to keep the drone level. Let's say it lands on an uneven surface or something. Also in this patent is the idea that the legs could act as shock absorbers. And also they could be tipped with things like spikes or screws or suction cups or even magnets that allow it to grip on different surfaces. Then there's another Amazon patent out there now showing adjustable winglets on the prop tips, and that's for the for flight efficiency. Interesting. And then finally, we have a video of the week. This comes from the commander of the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, General David G. Perkins. He was speaking at an Association of the United States Army annual meeting and exposition. Now, in the course of his talk, he stated that someone described as a very close U.S. ally, quote, dealing with an adversary flying a small quadcopter, unquote, get this now, fired a Patriot surface-to-air missile at the drone. Well, it worked. The drone is no more. Now, this is a rather expensive way to take down a drone. Patriot missiles are not inexpensive, but we received this video from a number of you all that said, you know, you've got to see this. So we'll have a link to that video in the show notes. Okay, we want to thank our guest, Dr. Benjamin Gould. We'll have a lot of links in the show notes to some of the articles, some of the resources concerning the activities that he's been involved in using fuel cells to power a drone, in this case, a fixed-wing drone. We'd also like to thank this episode's sponsors, Go Engineer, UAV Propulsion Tech, and USAS, Unmanned Systems and Solutions. You can find us at our website, theuavdigest.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's theuavdigest.com/187. We're on Twitter at UAV Digest. If you'd like to join our Slack listener team, this is a really nice little, basically a closed community. Just visit the uavdigest.com/team to learn more. Of course, we're on Facebook. Look for UAV Digest. If you want to send us some email, some feedback, you can just write to us. That's at feedback@theuavdigest.com. Of course, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and the Google Play Store. We have some swag available. You can find that at cafepress.com/theuavdigest. And if you'd like to contribute financially to the UAV Digest, you can visit our Patreon page. That's at patreon.com/theuavdigest. So with that, I'll say this has been Max in Hartford. Thanks for listening. This episode was sponsored in part by Unmanned Systems and Solutions. 30 USAS technicians repair all types of drones in their 120,000-square-foot professional drone repair facility. USAS also offers full-service operations consulting and programs for commercial and government users. Visit unmannedsas.com/UAVDigest to learn more about how to get your drone repaired.